Noise is a comedy show here on 2SER 107.3. And it's about to start. But before we begin, we have been told by basically everybody that we have to warn you about our language and themes, because it might be offensive to some listeners. So, if that's you, well, sorry.
Sup fam, this is Loud Noise coming at you live this sexy Sunday evening right here on 2SER 107.3. I'm Will, and in case you haven't heard, we're the only show in Sydney that doesn't have a bleeding heart for left-wing liberals or pander to that bloody noisy alt-right bullshit brigade. So check your virtue signalling at the door, spare yourself from any agenda-driven nonsense, and just enjoy the next half hour of random noise.
Hello, my people. I'm Hannah. We have a cracker of a show lined up for you this week. I'm going to slide right into one of the biggest hot-button issues, and yes, even good old ScoMo cares about this one, because ain't nothing happening but the rent. I got Casey Chambers.
Am I not pretty enough?
No, not that Casey Chambers, the one who's the executive director of Anglicare Australia, to come on and shoot some straight talk about dem bills, while William will descend into one of his usual mad genius crazy rant mode, if you could call it that, with all the usual lols and keks to keep your ears enthused.
So if you're trigger-averse or just a social justice or alt-right masochist, we got you, fam. But before we kick it off, though, make sure you get on over to ser.com/loudnoise. You can whine, moan and gripe and complain and bitch and moan at Loud Noise Show on Twitter, or check out our fancy stuff at thecentre.com.au. And yes, it's center with an ER. It's the American version. It made it more, you know, globally accessible, so deal with it.
But before we get into it, our corporate overlords have a word or two to say to all of you.
The countdown is on to Budget Night, Tuesday, May 9, when Treasurer Scott Morrison will outline the government's plan for the nation.
2SER will be live in Canberra, ready to tell you how this year's budget will play out.
We'll bring you in-depth coverage and commentary from the nation's capital.
Starting from 7:30 p.m. Tuesday, May 9, on 2SER 107.3.
You're listening to Loud Noise, the show that rules with an iron fist, and a copper foot, and a titanium crotch.
Sup fam, we are back. Sorry to bore you with that corporate noise, but anyway, there's been a lot happening this week in the news, and a lot of it has to do with Hannah's favouritest person in the world. No response?
Yeah, sorry, let me just clean up that vomit, because we are talking about the Donald Trump.
That was a bit social justice, forced liberal nonsense out of Hannah there, but anyway, but a lot has happened with Trump.
Yeah, he's had his first 100 days, and he's been saying that the job was just a little bit tougher than he thought it would be, and that he doesn't have much time to himself these days. I mean, what was he expecting as the leader of the free world? What do you reckon?
What was he expecting? Well, I don't think it was so much what he was expecting. I think he's got a big job ahead of him, because the Senate isn't behaving the way that he thought he would. They've got a 52-48, or is it 51-49 majority in the Senate, but still he hasn't been able to pass a lot of the things that he thought he'd get in the initial stages of his, like, 100 days. He thought he was going to get healthcare through, but the flawed healthcare plan that he tried to push through just wasn't going to work.
Yeah, I don't think he's had the smooth sail that he thought he'd had, and he's possibly had in all of his business deals in the past. But what about his stance on North Korea? Do you think that him amping up the sort of military and tough guy stance with Kim Jong-un is something that's actually going to work in the long term and actually have a nice solution for everybody?
Well, in the past week, though, he has made some promising, you know, he has sent some promising signals, like with China, and the fact that he's more, well, in conversations that he's had with China, that he's more inclined towards like a diplomatic solution. But there seems to be different sections of his administration that are after the more hawkish kind of approach when it comes to North Korea. And I don't think that that's necessarily the best approach that you can take, because by provoking North Korea, by sending these carriers, by sending the nuclear submarine there, it's like you're in situ being flamed. But the whole rhetoric that it should be only China that's negotiating with North Korea is also flawed. It's going to take like a village. It doesn't take one person.
Look, I absolutely agree with you there. We live in a global community, and it can't just be one country's problem. But do you think that with America moving in their anti-missile technology into South Korea, THAAD, do you think that's actually, you know, sort of giving the finger to China a little bit and not really going forward in a way that's sort of diplomatic and politically smart?
Definitely. But you can look at it from both sides. You can understand why... Like, I understand why the United States would do that. Like, that's always been part of their, like, operations within, like, the Asia-Pacific theater. They've always wanted to have South Korea as their, like... It's basically like a station, and especially because Japan has moved very far-right conservative with Shinzo Abe, it makes having that same relationship that they used to use Japan for a lot harder, and South Korea's always been open to, like, American interference, for lack of a better word, in the region. But it also comes at a time when there's heightened tensions, and China is expanding its own, you know, influence over the region, especially economically. So to have Thad be put there is probably not the best way they could have gone about doing what they did.
So do you think that sort of North Korea is China's little pawn and South Korea is America's, and it's actually two big guys having a pissing contest?
Yes, 100%. Because again, South Korea is, you could call it successful, but at the same time, having been there, you've been there as well, behind the main street of every road in South Korea, you find basically destitute slums. So it's a matter of, they're both being, like, the Korean Peninsula shouldn't be something that's used as a pawn, because there's how many people? Like, I think 20 million in North Korea. I don't have the figure for South Korea on mine now. They're being used as this theater of, like, this war games that's played between two major powers. And I've got to admit, I might work for one of those, but at the same time, you can't have a situation where these people's lives are at risk because other people decide they want to send, you know, nuclear submarines, and they want to send warships and aircraft carriers to the area, because the people that are going to suffer isn't going to be anyone living in mainland United States. It's going to be the people in Korea that are going to get bombed.
Yeah. And look, Trump's actually going to meet our Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, sometime in the near future, finally, after, that phone scandal.
I think it's next week, isn't it?
Yeah, possibly. So what do you think Turnbull's going to be saying to Trump about the whole thing?
I don't think Turnbull is going to be saying much that he'll tell the media that he's saying, because I don't think he's in a position. Australia is not in a position to be the major player that we like to believe that we are. Our military is weak compared to basically nearly every other country in the world. We do have a lot of natural resources, you know, and we have the same kind of values, and people look to Australia as, like, you know, a social kind of progressive kind of country. But Trump doesn't, honestly, like, in my opinion, he doesn't give two shits what Turnbull has to say. But it's just good to have him, from a media perspective, come, you know, pay homage to Trump and visit. And it looks good for Turnbull, and it shores up his far-right base here in Australia to say, yes, I met with Trump. We had productive discussions. You know, we call for swift and decisive action in North Korea, and using all these buzzwords. But let's be honest. Does Trump want to speak to China, or does Trump want to speak to Australia? Does Trump want to speak to Angela Merkel in Germany, or does Trump want to speak to Australia? Australia doesn't mean shit except for, like, the photo of the kangaroo and shaking hands and all that kind of stuff.
I guess it's more of, like, just a convenient thing to have in the region.
Yeah.
Little friend over there.
A partner that will push your line and have a little press conference and sit there using exactly the same terms that Trump used. Swift and decisive action. It's basically as though Sean Spicer wrote Turnbull's speech and Maurice Payne's speech when they had that little conference about North Korea. It's ridiculous.
Anyway, moving right along. Another kind of big topic in the media this week in Australia has been rent prices. And you'll all be feeling it, because it will be literally probably the most expensive thing you spend your wages on this week.
We are assuming, of course, that you're in the same demographic as we are.
Not even. I mean, there's people in their 40s that can't afford a house and are still renting.
For any 40-year-olds listening, we're very happy to have you listening, but why?
Anyway, I took a little look-see into the rental crisis that's sort of happening across the country, and it's not just in Melbourne and Sydney, as Barnaby Joyce would have you believe. It's actually in 94% of the places that were surveyed. So take a listen. It is a truth universally acknowledged that the housing market in Australia's major cities is overinflated, ridiculously expensive, and the bane of every average city dweller's existence. For the past couple of years, property experts have been predicting the bubble will burst and house prices will come tumbling down. In the meantime, though, first home buyers have been advised to grin and bear it and wait it out, saving a deposit in the rental market. What is a somewhat less universally acknowledged truth is that the rental market is almost as unaffordable as the property market. As a young, underemployed, recent graduate, the prospect of affording my own one-bedroom apartment to start my life as an independent young adult is one that is simply not available to me. I can't afford to fork out $600 a week for the luxury of having my own place and leaving the mess, the dirty dishes and the noise of a large share house behind. And that $600 doesn't even include water, electricity and cleaning bills. For many young graduates, the struggle to get into the job market is hard enough, with universities churning out graduates left, right and centre. I know quite a few young people who, like me, work two or three casual or part-time jobs to pay the bills. Often, at least one of these jobs is in the field that I or other students actually studied in, while the others are supplementary to offset the considerable expense of living in the city. But it's not just Australian cities where the rents are guzzling up the majority of people's wages. According to an annual study by Anglicare, 94% of rental properties across the country aren't affordable to people on minimum wage or on government benefits. Basically, people who are not earning a six-figure salary. Anglicare defines an affordable house or apartment as one that doesn't cost more than 30% of a person's weekly wage. Executive Director of Anglicare Casey Chambers says, on top of the steep rents, there's also been less properties on the rental market in the last year, meaning it really is slim pickings for people bringing home a small wage.
Single people, again, are the hardest hit in West Australia, the ACT and the Northern Territory. Not one single property out of those 67,500 would have been affordable for someone on Newstart or Youth Allowance. Single parents, again, also fare fairly badly. Nothing affordable in Sydney, Canberra, Adelaide, Darwin, Hobart or Brisbane. For people on disability support pension, only 0.9% would have been affordable.
Students, single parents, single people and people on government benefits are hard-pressed to find any places at all they can actually afford. Rather than being able to focus on their work or their studies or their children, they're faced with the constant, daunting battle of simply trying to pay the rent. Casey Chambers says when people are put under that level of rent stress, they start compromising other aspects of their life.
We've been talking to people for whom it's even as much as 80%, and obviously that's not sustainable. When you're talking about a minimum wage and people existing on that sort of $600 or so a week, and spending, $400 of that or so on rent, then there's not a lot left for anything else. And of course, the things that we're talking about there are, if you're a parent, school trips, the extras that come with children going to school, your own doctor's appointments, keeping a car on the road, particularly in regional areas. Often it's very difficult to hold down a job if you don't have a car, again, particularly in regional areas. So we're seeing people. We saw one lady who we've been talking to about this survey, who had less than $30 a week left after she'd paid her rent.
And children are also negatively affected.
What that means for people is that they are going to have to move at some stage. It means that whatever community they've been able to build around themselves in that rental property, they're not going to be able to necessarily move within that suburb or that area. It means disruption in work, disruption in children's school. Long term, we see people with real health issues around their concern and their worry and their anxiety about their accommodation options. We see people who do need to let go of their rental accommodation because they can't keep it up. We've even seen people who, with families, haven't been able to find new rental accommodation quickly enough, and children have had to go into foster care.
So what can low-income earners actually do about housing affordability? Deputy Prime Minister and leader of the Nationals, Barnaby Joyce, has publicly stated multiple times there is no national housing crisis.
There's not an Australian housing crisis, let's be quite clear on that. There's a housing crisis in Melbourne and Sydney. Now, there's no housing crisis in Toowoomba or Tamworth or Albury or Geraldton. There's no housing crisis as much in Perth.
And his advice to people who are disgruntled by the rising cost of houses and rent is simple.
If you want to get an affordable house, then a great way to do it is to move to a regional area, such as Tamworth, such as Albury, such as Geraldton, such as Toowoomba, such as Rockhampton, where houses are more affordable.
At present, that might be true for house prices on some level, but the snapshot done by Anglicare examined the whole country. And for someone taking home minimum wage, they're still going to be under severe rental stress, even if they move to Tamworth. Anglicare Executive Director Casey Chambers explains.
We surveyed 13,700 properties in regional areas, and they're that's right across the country. Even so, out of that 13,000 properties, only 18 would have been affordable if you're a single person on Newstart. Only 5% of them would have been affordable for somebody on the age pension. And even if you were single on the minimum wage, only 8.8, so nearly 9% would have been affordable. So first of all, that's not that easy. It's still not affordable. We looked, for example, at the town of Whyalla, which, you know, by most people's definition is out of a metropolitan area and is moving to a regional area. In Whyalla, we've had two major employers who have crashed this year, so the mine site and the smelting works. And yet still, in Whyalla, nothing was affordable for a single parent or anybody on a government benefit. So that's the simple answer. It wouldn't be affordable.
And there's one other problem with rural and regional areas which no amount of affordable housing would make up for.
If there's no work there, then there's not a lot of point in people moving there. We need to be thinking about helping these regional centres develop work, develop jobs, and then the housing would follow. But certainly just simply saying to people who've got, you know, perhaps very little support systems around them and not a lot of money to simply, you know, get on their bike or pack the car and move to these areas, they're not that likely to find anywhere affordable there either.
Even Barnaby Joyce has acknowledged the need to develop rural and regional areas to make them a more viable option for young people and young families trying to make ends meet.
What we have to do, though, is make sure that the availability for jobs are in there. And that's why we drive for things like Adani Mine to bring jobs into central Queensland, or move APVMA to Armidale to take jobs to Armidale. And in those areas, there are affordable houses and gives the opportunity for people to buy a house and pay it off. And this seems a perfectly reasonable outcome.
So what then is the solution? Casey Chambers has a few ideas.
In the budget, we need to see the federal government bring forward a plan that is long-term, that is visionary, that isn't, you know, tinkering around the edges. There's lots of great ideas, and no one idea is going to work for everything, but we need some leadership, and we need to see a long-term plan. We certainly need to have a look at negative gearing and capital gains tax. We've been banging on about this for a number of years. It is one heck of a lot of money that comes out of the public purse into private pockets. And we think it's time that the government asked for something back for that. And that would be around extended tenancies, greater security, rents that were not subject to rise, perhaps linked to properties in particular areas where we've got particular housing supply issues. So there's lots of ways to target negative gearing. We'd certainly like to see it wound back over time. We certainly need to keep up that funding to homelessness services. As I say, we can't ignore the people who have actually not got a roof over their head, whether it's so we need to keep the money up for homelessness services. We need to look at renters' rights, not to say that, you know, we're going to give the tenants from hell a free ride, but to actually say, look, you know, there's a balance here, there's a contract between someone who needs a home and somebody who has a house for rent. But we need to make sure that there's decent notice periods, that can't be, the rent can't be put up quickly without planning. And we need to make sure that we're including public housing and social housing in all sorts of planning with inclusionary zoning and schemes like that. And we can't not talk about the level of income. You know, a minimum wage is less and less a living wage as rent prices go up. And certainly, as we can see, the dire lack of affordability for people on government benefits, we've got to increase those so that it is actually a safety net and not a poverty trap.
You're listening to Loud Noise, the show that served with a side of pulled pork, smashed avocados, slapped potatoes, and sexually harassed toast.
Pauline Hanson, long one of the most divisive figures in Australian politics, has managed to rebirth like Lazarus, and much like the alleged rapist in King's Cross, burst from prison on the front foot to reclaim the status that she once held. And as she has, the mainstream media has played its role in fueling her recent ascent, devoting column inch after column inch, TV block after TV block, to covering the random attention-grabbing statements that fly out of her mouth as though they're designed precisely for that purpose, to goad an ever-hungry media construct into providing what she needs the most, coverage. And it's worked. It most definitely has worked, which attests to why I'm telling you about it right now. But it is more than that. While the media and the pundits and the academics and anyone else with an opinion will sit there pining and opining and finding themselves wrapped into a fluster about what she's saying, they're missing the point entirely. Because Pauline Hanson is not what they make her out to be. In fact, she isn't even what she thinks she is, or anyone else for that matter. Now, when you think about the state of the country as it is right now, you could draw your attention to the trivial. The ongoing 18C debates, the who said what about who and how that makes you feel debate. You could. You'd probably be from an inner city affluent area, having never ventured out into the suburbs, let alone the proper real deal boonies. But of course, you could. You could sit and whine about cultural appropriation. You could take a stab at the ever-present patriarchy, grunt and groan about men, white people, black people, green, yellow, blue, and goats for all it matters. But then you'd be missing the point. The real issue. The issue that has always been the issue. The issue that those Zuccotti Parkers had dead to rights but had no bloody way to deal with is that of who has the money, the power. What purpose does it serve going after those from low socioeconomic environments who are looking for someone to blame and then deriding them even further by calling them racists and bogans and all manner of things, when the real issue, the truest issue, is that which is probably staring at you in the face when you look into the mirror? Now, in Australia, we have a welfare system which is second to none and the bane of many. In reality, the welfare that we provide those who are the poorest is basically a means of ensuring there is no obvious serf class. No favelas, no reason for armed revolt, as foolish as that may sound to you. Centrelink is a means of control, of ensuring docility amongst the downtrodden many. Hence why a third of our budget is afforded to the welfare system. But here's the thing. Much like Centrelink is the means of the masses in a financial sense, Pauline Hanson is the Centrelink of the masses politically. Yes, Pauline Hanson is political Centrelink. And while both sides of the political aisle might not have come up with such an insightful metaphor, if I say so myself, they both know it. To many, she provides a voice that they feel is being ignored. Long marginalised by those in power, with income equality further and further drifting to be but a distant memory of a time long ago, the voice that she provides is one of the little man, the downtrodden, he or she without a seat at the table, let alone an invitation to the building. Unless, of course, they're cleaning it up afterwards. This is the real problem. We are all so happy to gloss over the conditions that create this environment for our own personal gain, and yet when they do occur, we are all so quick with our buzzwords and denigration of people who don't agree with us. So many times, too numerous to count, I've been in situations where throngs of Liberati will gather to espouse the same tired bullshit about themselves, the working man, to whine about how they can't afford a house in this environment, how they can't have, do, or get something, and yet they're living in the inner city, they dress exceptionally well, and they go to work in fancy organisations and have, by global standards, what can be described as a well beyond average life. And these same people, and for the sake of this narrative, this is Sydney by the way, have never ventured to Fairfield or Bankstown or La Kemba or Blacktown or Campbelltown or Mount Druitt or any damn where the struggle isn't what I can't get, but rather, how can I feed my kids today? And don't get me wrong, this isn't limited to Sydney, by all means not. And in particular in Queensland, where Hanson enjoys her widest following, there are admittedly a lot more people of the Anglo variety. But for the purposes of this assessment, it doesn't matter. Because the people that Pauline Hanson speaks to aren't just those who are bound by a particular race, rather the ties that bind are those of economic slavery. While countries like China are investing huge sums of money to build their burgeoning middle class, to drag people out of poverty, here in Australia we have chosen to follow the American lead of getting as much as we can for ourselves as fast as we can. Which, okay, look, in itself this isn't the worst thing, but we've also imported the hypocrisy and judgment that pervades the narrative, which just makes it all outright ludicrous. We are the reason that a Pauline Hanson thrives. The assumption that anyone who supports her is an idiot, a scumbag, a racist, a malingering grub. That we of the intelligentsia are so far removed and above any prejudice, living in our echo chambers protected by bubbles and policed by political correctness. The path this country is trotting down now has an endgame that's devoid of logic. To advance, to truly advance as a society, fierce and open debate is required. Debate that isn't about blocking out any dissent, losing the rights of free speech, free thought, but rather having the best bloody argument and being able to come to a consensus where we all get a little bit of what we want rather than a privileged few. Because then, and only then, will the likes of Pauline Hanson, the political centrelink of the masses, no longer be necessary.
Greetings, people from the future. You are listening to Loud Noise on 2SER 107.3.
Oh, they'll make you teary when those right-wingers tell you clearly truths you won't believe. That'll make you stressed. But when you get teary, try a little trigger fest. Yeah. On your Twitter waiting, just anticipating mean tweets that you can share and echo left, yeah. But while you're complaining, don't forget, honey, now to have your little trigger fest, yeah. That's what you gotta do. Just fundamental, no, it's not. 'Cause your politics, no one cares, yeah. And all those mean words make you temperamental, yes, they do. Makes it easier. To get you there, yeah. So don't forget it when you're scrolling through your Reddit. Your feelings are just a shield from the meanness, yes, they are. But you're just so easy. So all you gotta do is try a little. Trigger fest, yeah. It's all you gotta do now.
You can tell the sun in his jealous sky when we walked in fields ago.
Ladies and gentlemen, Sting.
Loud Noise.
Hey fam, we know you want more, but you don't always get what you want unless... unless you slide on over to 2SER.com/loudnoise, you can gag and beg for it at Loud Noise Show on Twitter, or let your fingers do the stalking at thecentre.com.au.
That's with an ER, centre with an ER, people, like the American Centre.
Or the television show with George Clooney.
Absolutely. Now it's time for your weekly dose of abandonment. Yes, we're leaving you to the wolves that are Jailbreak. who will murder your ears with some sweet, sweet tunes and some dulcet tones and goodness knows what else. And we'll be heading home to the safety and warmth of our homes. For the Loud Noise team, I'm Hannah.
And I'm William. Have a great night. And remember, the left is never right, and the right is batshit crazy.